made by the National County of Juvenile and Family Court Judges. Judge Harrell is the chair of that council. And this is an excerpt. This is not the whole report, but I've excerpted page 20, which is the last page in that packet, that the recommendation is that judges should not issue mutual protective restraining orders for the reasons that that I've given, basically, that they're unfair. And also, another reason why we're concerned about mutual restraining orders as well as mutual arrests is that both of these things are disincentives, discourage people who this law is intended to protect from actually seeking the protection that the law is supposed to afford. If a person is being battered and they think that when they call the police, there's a chance or a good chance that they're going to be arrested and hauled off to jail as well as their attacker, this person's relative likelihood or their inclination to actually invoke the protection of the police.
Why don't you just go ahead. I'm happy to move on. I didn't mean to.
No, but I think that that's an important point, is that we don't want to chill people's access to the court system, and protection of the court system that has been established. I'd also say that nothing in this bill precludes a respondent from seeking a restraining order when the respondent has the grounds to do so in a separate proceeding. The respondent, if he or she wants a restraining order, can file his or her own. The other changes that are made in Section 2 of the bill are, first, that it authorizes municipal police officers to serve restraining orders in the following narrow circumstance: where the police officer is at the scene of a domestic disturbance, the respondent is at the scene, and a copy of the restraining order is reasonably available or available within a reasonable time for the peace officer to serve. We're not advocating that peace officer service become the norm here. We're just advocating that in that narrow instance, it's appropriate for a police officer who's on the scene to serve a restraining order that has not yet been otherwise served. Finally, the Section 2 of the bill sets out a form on which the respondent can request a hearing or must use to request a hearing on the restraining order. Now the law simply provides that the respondent need only to request a hearing without specifying what's being contested. So the petitioner, who gets notice that the respondent has requested a hearing, does not know what the respondent is asking for a hearing about, whether the respondent is contesting whether there's been any incident that gave rise to the restraining order in the first place, or whether
reason to say that in the original award of the restraining order?
The petitioner has to state the grounds for the restraining order when the petitioner seeks one. The respondent does not need to say why he or she's asking for a hearing, and this bill would require the respondent to do so.
Thank you.
Thank you. Be happy to answer any questions. And I have provided testimony to the committee, written testimony.
That's why we are hurrying me through.
Okay.
We read faster than you do. Holly.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Holly Pruitt. I'm the director of the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. I just have one brief illustrative piece to add. Our office gets dozens of calls every week from shelter workers and lawyers and lay advocates around the state, and many of those are directed to our staff attorney, Judith Armada, and relate to problems with enforcement and implementation of the laws. And from those, we're able to glean what the top issues are. And this problem of mutual arrest is one that seems to be getting worse and worse and really is undermining the original intent of the law. For the hearings that were held in the House, we had battered women and their advocates who traveled from Columbia County, from Eastern Oregon, from Southern Oregon, and one woman who returned from out of state where she's in hiding to tell their stories. And I brought you the testimony that's signed by Marcy Westerling of one of those advocates, just so you have one of these case examples before you. And I'll just very briefly run through that. Their office, the Columbia County Women's Resource Center, is in St. Helens, and it's across the street from the courthouse. And a 19-year-old woman was sent there directly from being released from jail. The city worker at the jail was surprised to see such a nice, proper woman being arrested and commented that she couldn't imagine how this woman who was under 5'2" would have posed such a serious threat to her husband to have been held in jail. This woman came and shared her story with the Columbia County folks. She didn't understand why she'd been arrested. She said that the previous evening her husband had returned home in a very violent state. He had a history of battering her, and that this had taken the form of blows and vicious words. But that night it appeared that the battering was going to be much more intense. She had yelled at him to stop, but his violence increased. When she ran from him, he caught her. And in the bedroom, he placed her in a chokehold that landed them both in the bedroom closet. As she lay on the floor of the bedroom closet with his hands around her throat and his words threatening to kill her, she felt great fear, and she reached up and scratched her abusive husband in the face to gain release from that chokehold. The scratch diverted his attention, and the woman gained release. Shortly after, the police arrived, and they had apparently been alerted by neighbors because of her screams. The police arrested both of them, calling the violence mutual combat. The male bailed himself out within the hour, while the woman spent 15 hours in jail. He pled not guilty to all charges, and all charges were dropped. The woman pled guilty, however, and had to pay a fine. When asked why she pled guilty, she said that they had asked her if she had scratched him, and she had responded yes. She said that no one ever asked her why she had scratched him, and no one seemed to care that she'd only scratched him in self-defense. Shortly after, in fact, the next day, this particular woman chose to move out of state, and she stated embarrassment and awareness that the system could not keep her safe as her motives for relocating. The Columbia County Women's Resource Center says that this is a fairly typical response on the part of their local law enforcement, and they, like other advocates around the state, feel that House Bill 2994, by reinforcing the obligation of the police officer to determine who is the assailant and to arrest that person, would prevent such miscarriages of justice in the future. Thank you for your consideration of this important bill.
Thank you. Are there questions, Holly? Judith?
I really have no testimony to prepare or to present.
You're very
if you
clever.
Have any questions.
Yes, thank you. are there any amendments to this bill?
No, Madam Chair, not to my knowledge.
Does anyone want to
move
offer any amendments to this bill? Senator Springer moves House Bill 2994. Unamended to the floor with a DFAS recommendation. Okay. Further comments, discussion? Call the roll, please. Thank you.
Senator Hamby.
Aye.
Senator Springer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill.
Aye.
Chair Cohen.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you very much. Okay. We've got three more bills for people here. Mary Alice Hammond, House Bill 2218. 2218. I'd like to get out of here by 7:30, folks. Mary Alice, you'll help us do that, won't you?
I will. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mary Alice Hammond, Administrator of the Workers' Compensation Board. House Bill 2218 is a really simple bill. It's in the nature of housekeeping in that it originally eliminated the requirement that workers' compensation referees certify that transcripts were correct. The bill was amended in the House to eliminate the requirement that the referees do it, but to require that the transcriber certify the transcript as being an accurate and complete record of the proceedings. The bill was also amended by the House Judiciary Committee to require that a list of exhibits be included with the transcript as opposed to the copying and reproducing exhibits. The bill was passed unanimously by the House Judiciary Committee and on the House floor. There was no testimony other than from the board in support of the bill. It's real non-controversial. I'd be glad to go into detail about how we do transcripts now and the delays that that caused in the process and why this serves no useful purpose if you want to hear that. But I'll leave it at that, and you can ask questions if you like.
Thank you. Are there questions of Mary Alice? Mr. Taylor, you have any comments, questions, amendments?
No.
Anyone else have any comments, questions, amendments?
Move House Bill 2218 to the floor for due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Hill moves House Bill 2218 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Call the roll, please.
Senator Hamby.
Aye.
Senator Springer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill.
Aye.
Chair Cohen.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you very much. Okay. Let's take Roger Lent from the Employment Division in House Bill 2082.
I think we're on a roll here.
I think we are.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Roger Lent with the Employment Division. I'm here in support of House Bill 2082, which was sponsored by or requested by the Employment Division to change the way we do file our liens. I think it is a good tool for simplifying the way we file our collection tools, and also it makes us more efficient in our collecting. Basically, what this bill does, it allows the Employment Division to attach a lien to real and personal property by recording one document instead of two. At the present time, if we want to file a lien, we have to file a regular lien with the county, which attaches real and personal property. And we have another method, which is a warrant, which is our tool of choice because it acts as a judgment and we can act on that. So basically, what we're looking at is that we want the warrant to replace be the document that creates the lien under our lien law. So instead of having to file a warrant with the county and a lien, we can just file the warrant.
What did the county say about that? Do they care?
The county didn't care, no.
Does the county clerk care?
No. Basically, it's what it do. It would reduce the amount of work they would actually have to do because right now we file a warrant with the county clerk, and that is what we normally do. We file this warrant because we can go out then and we can issue garnishments or anything else like you could any other judgment. The only time we'd ever use a lien at the present time is if we wanted to file the lien and then file it with the Secretary of State to create a lien statewide on all personal property. And it hasn't been very practical for us because the warrant has been so successful. What we want to do, instead of having to file the two documents, is get the warrant to be the document that creates a lien. And then we could file that lien, or the warrant, also with the Secretary of State, which would put that broad coverage to all personal property throughout the state.
Well, I guess I don't have any questions. I wonder whether we have our Eagle Beagle Senator Shoemaker here. We're missing him. Look at this. If we passed it out without him, he'd probably sink it on the floor with questions, right? Anyway, do the other committee members have questions about this? Senator Springer, what do you think?
Well, I don't see it. Usually our friends in the financial interest community and the title community and anybody else who cares about liens or encumbrances or priorities show up. Did they appear on the House side or... To your knowledge, have any of those folks expressed any concern about this procedure that you've outlined here? Maybe Mr. Taylor's got some information for us.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I did call Frank Bronner the other day and tell him about this bill, and he said he would take a look at it. I don't see him here, so I take it that his absence indicates no problem. Maybe assuming too much, but...
Okay. Well, I suppose...
I'm ready to move it, Madam Chair.
Yeah, and then we'd ask...
If Senator Shoemaker develops a problem that can't be resolved, we'll bring it back.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Was there any opposition at all?
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, no opposition. And it did pass the House, you know.
Yeah, well, we don't really.
Didn't have
that has very little. Once it gets out of the committee in either of our houses, it sort of goes to the drops someplace else.
Decide today on a bill I carry, yes. No.
Yeah. Anyway, well, I guess then I'd certainly accept a motion. Senator Green, you want to move House Bill 2082 to the floor with a due press recommendation. We'll ask Bill to make sure he runs this one by Shoemaker and anyone else who might have a concern about it in the next couple of days before we file the bill, and then we'll bring it back if there is. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Further discussion about Senator Springer's motion to pass House Bill 2082 to the floor with a due press recommendation. Call the roll, please, Mark.
Senator Hamby.
Aye.
Senator Springer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill.
Aye.
Chair Cohen.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. Okay. 3545. Karen Hightower.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for your record, my name is Karen Hightower, and I'm appearing on behalf of the Oregon Judicial Department. Did my written testimony get passed out?
It's probably coming.
This bill was drafted at the request of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. It's one of several cost-saving suggestions that the Judicial Department presented to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means at that committee's request. This is one of the cost-saving measures they chose to go forward with. Basically, the main purpose of this bill is to save state court mailing costs. Currently, under ORS 107-092, court clerks separately mail a notice of continuing health insurance coverage to both the petitioner and the respondent each time a dissolution petition or suit for legal separation is filed with the court. Basically, this bill proposes to eliminate this mailing expense and require the petitioner in a dissolution proceeding to furnish the respondent with the health insurance notice.
How are you going to ensure that gets done?
Well, basically, it just, instead of saying the court clerk has the is supposed to do this, it just says the petitioner is required to do it, so it would be enforced in the same manner it would be enforced against the court clerk.
I'm afraid this bill may not go. I remember here when we, remember, Dick, when we had the support enforcement things when we left it, we didn't collect any of the information, didn't send notices to people. And then we came back a few years, we got it, and we found out that people.
Yeah, I recall that very well. I think in 81 or 83, we were
probably not
persuaded.
It's not the same issue.
It's
but
not the same issue.
But it's a. So if you get a dissolution and you're expecting my ex-husband, who's mad at me anyway, to tell me that, to send me a notice to make sure that our joint or his health care is going to tell me a continuation notice and I got to pay the premiums for the next 6 months.
Well, basically, the policy issue for the committee is whether the state should be responsible to inform the parties what the impact of the dissolution is on their health insurance, or should the petitioner or the petitioner's attorney be responsible for informing the petitioner what the impact is and then have a notice sent to the respondent. And basically, it's just a policy issue. And it's, should the state be doing this, or should it be the burden of the private litigants to do this? Should all the Oregon taxpayers pay for the courts to mail this, or should litigants
sometimes
have the burden?
Sometimes if we don't have health care coverage, the state gets the bill sooner in any event. But I don't know.
Do we have an example of what the document is or the notice is that's mailed?
That, and this is the document that you mail, but there's no requirement that any private, that my ex-husband would get around to mailing me anything, especially if he didn't have a lawyer.
Yeah.
Especially, you know.
I think this may go backwards on all the things we've been trying to do today. For $50,000, it may not be worth it.
Madam Chair, this is the notice that is now written by the insurance division and provided by the court.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Hill.
Is there a sanction if the petitioner doesn't do this?
It's currently written. No.
How would you sanction it?
Pardon?
I don't. Not issue a decree.
Right. You don't get your divorce until you send this out.
Yeah.
They probably take more clerk's time trying to explain to the petitioner why he has to send this out to his client than if you just plain put the 25-cent stamp on and sent it. But we'll see. Further questions? I think this is good to have this notice to know exactly what we're talking about. Questions? Thank you. Thanks.
I wouldn't mind increasing the fee to cover the cost, but...
You can do that. I don't know what, you know, I suppose that...
How much do you pay for filing? I mean, presumably the filing fee you pay for a divorce is, what, $85, $100? $200?
Charlie, you want to have a comment on this?
No, it's more for divorce than anything else, so it's about double.
Yeah.
I guess
one Mark presumes. Will know. Mark will tell us.
The three highest counties for filing fees for petition. Oh, on the record, Mark Thorburn, former divorce lawyer. The three highest counties are in order are Clackamas, Multnomah, and Marion counties. In each case, the filing fee for a divorce petitioner is over $200. On the other hand, the filing fee for a respondent in virtually every county that I'm aware of is only about $70. Filing fees for petitioners, the lowest county I'm aware of is Polk County, and there it's, I believe, about right now at $105.
Okay, thanks. I think we'll see. We'll cogitate about this a little, see whether. Okay, we have one quick bill, I guess. What are you waiting for? You have something on the agenda, Charlie? $25.93. Oh, do you want, does the committee want to take that up? See where they have the votes.
Move the bill. Could we adopt the amendments first?
Do we have amendments?
There are amendments to the bill, which I hopefully can find right now, which
I'll
clarify what a step person.
Okay. Right. Then we have, we'll find the bill. We're looking for 25. It's really late, folks. We've had a very long day, and I appreciate the committee members who stay here and work like this. But we've got, while we're finding things and getting ourselves located, we really basically have 2 weeks left. So that's why we have a little work to do. The committees are supposed to close June 7th. And I think that we better make sure that we are prepared to close June 7th. And so that's why, you know, for the next couple of weeks, we're going to try to churn away a couple nights a week like this and get some of these things out of here. That 2 weeks, then we'll sort of all be free from this and just sort of hanging around during the day.
Conference committees,
if you have.
Charlie, they were a -1 amendment, right? Is there a need for the sub 5? Legal guardian, yes, huh?
Yes.
Okay, I'll move -1, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Okay. 25. Let me find more. Senator Hanby is anxious to go home.
Yes.
The -1 amendment, Senator Hanby has moved the -1 amendments. Yes, I myself wondered whether we have legal guardian. That's the definition of legal guardian. Right.
Yeah, I just remembered, but Senator Shoemaker was upset about the legal guardian, and if you want to delete legal guardian from the bill,
okay, good. That's why. I had a note there myself.
I think maybe we just do that. Do you mind?
No.
Bill, if we can, Spinger, do you mind if we do? I think that there's lots of questions when you get into legal guardian.
If that brings Shoemaker on board, so be it.
Yeah.
Okay, then Hanby will amend her motion to move the dash one amendment, deleting the definition of legal guardian and from the bill the words legal guardian on line 10. I found it. Okay?
Line 9.
Oh, I've got the original bill. Oh, sorry.
It's both.
Yeah, okay, it is line 9, too. Okay. So we're taking out legal guardian in both places. Are there objections to Senator Hanby's motion? Hearing none, so ordered. Thank you.
Move it as amended to the floor. Do pass.
Okay. Senator Hill moves Senate House Bill 2593 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Call the roll, please. Mark.
Senator Hanby.
Aye.
Senator Springer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill.
Aye.
Chair Cohen.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. Passes. Okay. Let's, we have 10, we've got, do we want to do 2268? Do we have, or 2668, or what do you think about that one? Do we want the rest of the committee here for that? This is the one that extends the time for tort actions for child abuse.
Right, Madam Chair, to 6 years after the age of 18 or 3 years from the date of discovery, or discovery should have been made. I have an amendment which would put an ultimate statute of repose on the bill, which would be the age of 40 of the victim. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is because as the bill's written, it could currently go even longer.
So I'm willing to bring this back for committee discussion if you think this is a magic bill. We have one more quick one, 1064. Ingrid, a little civil penalty bill. We'll get this. This is a House, I mean, a Senate bill. We'd like to get this one out. There's no one signed up.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the witnesses were here earlier. I noticed they're not in the audience, and Senator Timms was not able to attend. But basically, this bill comes from the Committee on Transportation, and what it does is direct the Public Utility Commission to study and adopt rules regarding safe routes for transportation of hazardous substances. And it then adds the violation of such rules to the civil penalty provisions that the PUC has and also to the criminal penalty provisions. Civil penalty is referenced on page 1 of the bill in lines 17 and 18. It's $10,000 for per day of violation. I understand that that's in compliance with some federal provision relating to what the amount of these penalties ought to be. With respect to the criminal penalty on page 2, we're looking at line 10 of the bill, it amounts to a Class A misdemeanor, although it has a $10,000 per day maximum penalty rather than the standard $2,500. And again, the PUC does have current authority to impose criminal penalties for similar violations. And I understand that ordinarily the state police are involved in enforcing this provision, and the criminal penalties are ones that, for whatever reason, are easier for them to enforce.
So you don't, do you see any need for any kind of, this bill is here for us to review the sort of penalty side of things, and
that's
Ingrid's correct. Looked it over with her eagle eye.
And the PUC has basically been exempted out of the 101 of Senate Bill 101. They have a very distinct procedure which governs all of the penalties they impose, and this bill would come under that procedure rather than the 101 procedure.
I thought the penalties, the civil penalties, have always been there. They haven't.
Well, they have a different sort of way of doing things there. Yeah. Okay. Anybody have any problems with this, sending it on to the floor?
I see there's a fiscal, but I guess transportation weighed that in.
It's 200. Well, let's go to Ways and Means then. Is it $200,000?
Yes, sir.
$216,000.
Yeah, we better send it to W&M.
Okay.
Okay, I noticed that earlier. Okay, let's make that motion, Springer.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Pass, Ways and Means.
Thank you. Senator Springer moves Senate Bill 1064, do pass to Ways and Means Committee. Discussion, call the roll, please, Mark.
Senator Hamby?
Aye.
Senator Springer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill?
Aye.
Chair Cohen?
Thank you. Aye. Thank you.
Dispute resolution?
Yes, we did that.
Oh, good. I was going to say, why am I still carrying it?
We did it. Thank you, folks.
We've all been carrying it.